the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, May Martinez. The L.A. County Board of Supervisors have made some tweaks to their COVID rules. For example, no outdoor social gatherings of more than 15 people. That could be good if it's enforced. Hear why Supervisor Sheila Kuehl doesn't have much confidence that Sheriff Alex Villanueva will actually enforce it. That's all coming up on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for being with us today. Well, first it was the state, and now it's Los Angeles County's turn to restrict activity again to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Last night, the Board of Supervisors agreed to new curtailments recommended by the Health Department, and they start this Friday. Now, in just a few minutes, we're going to talk about what all of this means for LA Unified's plans to return to campus. But to start off, we're going to dig into the details of these restrictions, review what we can and cannot do right now, and what further rules might be imposed later if, as a community, we can't bring the case count down. Because if the rates continue to get worse in the coming weeks, another stay-at-home order could be on the table. Now, some of the new rules will only have a slight effect on what we see already. Indoor activities such as shopping, as well as outdoor activities such as dining, can still happen, but with tighter limits on capacity. One of the things that is new, all non-essential businesses must shut their doors to customers from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. every night. So when we spoke about it earlier today with Board Supervisor Sheila Kuehl, we asked her about the merits of this recommendation and how measures such as this might help flatten the curve.
Their recommendation about closing from 10 to 6 really had to do with people sort of hanging out a long time, you know, when you're in a restaurant or a brewery or a winery, you don't have your mask on when you're at the table, and that can be more of a problem. The same with retail establishments late at night. There just seems to be less adherence. The thinking is closing from 10 to 6, we will have less people who are sort of non-adherent and staying longer and hanging out.
Are we talking about a younger demographic that late at night?
It could be, but I think even my generation's pretty restless these days. I think it might be a lot of younger people who also feel, oh, I'm not going to get sick because I'm young, which, of course, is wrong because the greatest growth that we've seen in the numbers is in the demographic between the ages of 18 and 24.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the updated limit on gatherings, last month, supervisors said only outdoor gatherings are permitted from no more than three households, as we've mentioned. Last night, you revised that, but also putting a cap on people, a limit of 15. That could put a damper on some people's Thanksgiving dinners. But what's the rationale with the number 15?
It always seems a little arbitrary when you look at numbers. But we're thinking that with 15 people, you could possibly control the six-foot distance rule. The state said no more than three households getting together, but people have said, well, my extended family is one household. No, household is a group of people who actually live together. So, you know, you go to a park and you see 100 people gathered around a children's birthday party. And you have to say to yourself, what are they thinking? I mean, it is dangerous. So that was the thinking behind 15.
When it comes to these gatherings, so I'm wondering, Supervisor, how all of this will be enforced? Because whatever measures you institute, I mean, can you count on county sheriffs to enforce this restriction despite the board's very tense relationship with the sheriff's department lately?
Well, even if we had a good relationship with the sheriff's department, you know that they couldn't police everybody's backyard.
Sure.
So we have to really rely on people doing the right thing. You know, it's not a crime if you do this. You're simply going to be cited. But I really think that people somehow have the impression, oh, they can't mean me. But we do.
Yeah, and I realize that these backyard gatherings, the gatherings inside people's homes, would be tough for a sheriff's department to try and kind of watch after and then cite these people. But the situation that you described, being at a park where there's almost 100 people gathered together, something like that, how much confidence do you have that the sheriff's department would actually cite these kinds of gatherings if they see them or someone calls on these gatherings?
Well, it's interesting you ask because the sheriff has indicated to us that he's going to withdraw all of his deputies from our parks. you know, he keeps, I'm going to use the word whining because I'm really nonplussed at his attitude about it, but he keeps whining that we have cut his budget and therefore he can't staff up. But as you know, our own county budget went down $660 million because people are not paying us the same taxes that they were. People are not working. They're broke. So we cut every department, including the sheriff, but we encouraged him to cut his custody officers because his population is down in the jails. Mm-hmm. And instead, he said, no, I'm going to withdraw all my deputies from the parks. So we told him, well, you can't do that. And if you do that, we'll take the money away from you and give it to the parks to hire some other security. So,
oh, wow. Hmm.
You know, what the media tends to say is a tense situation. From my point of view, and I'll just say it for me, we're the grown-ups in the room. I don't understand what Alex is doing and why he's been so petulant about it. And I think irresponsible. So it is even less likely that the sheriff will enforce things in the parks. But the sheriff's park department deputies are only in county parks. Okay. In cities, you have, you know, their own law enforcement, and they've been better about trying to encourage people to do the right thing. But as I said, it's not an offense you get arrested for. Honestly, it comes down to personal responsibility, and I just wish everybody listening would say, oh, I get it. This is really serious. We could all end up in the hospital.
Ideally, yeah. It would be on people, on citizens. But really quick, would it be fair to say, Supervisor, you have more confidence in, say, the LAPD or individual cities' police departments to enforce this instead of your own sheriff's department?
I do, although LAPD has indicated to us that they have problems, too. There are just too many places, you know, for them to be allocating a lot of officers to do this. I think most law enforcement are trying to figure out what to do, because when you add this duty to all of the other things that they're required to do, they've all indicated this is very difficult. I think it's a very difficult time for everybody. And the United States is an interesting place because we value liberty so much. And a lot of people are kind of interpreting that to mean, well, I can do anything I want. I'm just going to take care of myself and maybe my family. But it is absolutely imperative now that we think about the other guy and wear our masks and wash our hands and keep our distance, because pretty soon the other guy is going to be you and you're going to be the one to get sick.
We're talking to Los Angeles County Supervisor Sheila Kuehl. You mentioned my favorite word, Supervisor, and that's masks. Let's hear from someone who really, really likes masks. That's UCLA infectious disease specialist Anne Ramoyne. I asked her what could be done to curb the spread of the virus without shutting shops and restaurants down again. I asked her this yesterday. Let's hear what she said.
We know that masks work. And if everybody wore a mask, we would see a significant reduction in cases. But it's all about layering on. So if everybody wore a mask, that would be number one.
And then on Monday, Governor Gavin Newsom instituted a new order that people wear masks even outdoors unless they are actively eating or drinking. Supervisor, since we were just talking about enforcement, wondering, will L.A. County be doing anything to ensure that that mask rule is enforced locally?
Well, that is a lot easier, actually, in the eating and drinking department, because we send like 1,000 people out every day to inspect our restaurants. And they're saying, well, we want to comply because we want to stay open, and we know we're going to be cited if we don't and could be shut down. So there, I think we're a little more successful. But as I said, where people are bicycling or walking or running along a street, they just take their masks off and they don't understand that there is still a danger when they pass people. So I hope that people, I know it's uncomfortable. I know it's harder to breathe, but I'm almost 80 and I'm doing it. So if I can do it, you can do it.
Now, on top of these new rules rolled out this week, you've left on the table that if cases or hospitalizations reach a certain level, that the county will institute a 3-week safer at home order that limits people from leaving their homes. Based on the projections, Supervisor, that you've seen so far, how likely or possible is that?
Well, I thought we were pretty good at the beginning. It is still just as dangerous as it was. I do think that people are seeing this spike as a serious thing, possibly for them. The major problem is if you don't have a an essential worker in your family, someone who is at risk because they work in the health system or they must go to work because they're essential. The east part of the San Fernando Valley has the highest number of essential workers of anywhere in my district, and that also is leading to the spike. So people need to understand they are putting others at risk. They are putting people with health, underlying health conditions at risk. If they don't comply, they are hurting other people, the very people we're counting on to save us when we get sick.
You know, the sound of all this, Supervisor, might be really frustrating to people that have had to endure living this way for 8 to 9 months now. Why wasn't there a discussion about maybe doing a very strict lockdown with strict enforcement for several weeks, say at the beginning of all of this, going past May in order to maybe stamp this out? I mean, it could have been harsh for those few weeks, but what we've seen for months feels like a Band-Aid over a bleeding wound.
Well, early on, as you know, we did have a safer at home order. And we pretty much hunkered in. Remember everybody buying 500 rolls of toilet paper?
Yes,
I mean, we thought we were all going to be, you know, home forever. But the problem is there was a bit of magical thinking about how we could probably open up. And the key word is safely. Everybody was going to open up safely. And, you know, we were going to keep people distanced and we were going to make them stand in line outside at a distance. And restaurants, we even allowed restaurants to open up inside for a little while. And then we saw, no, that was just magical thinking. So we stopped letting restaurants serve inside, but have tried to do kind of a not a lockdown, but only serve outside, only serve at a distance. And under the new rule, it's 50% of outdoor capacity now is all that's going to be allowed. So I expect to see our restaurants moving some of their tables inside not to be used. So there's more distance and less people in their outside area. It's hard on them. I get that it's hard on them. But we've got to get a handle on this.
Now, Governor Newsom has also advised, not mandated, advised that people who travel into the state from elsewhere should self-isolate for a couple of weeks. I'm wondering, Supervisor, is a countywide travel restriction in some form or another at all on the table or doable?
It's not on the table. I don't know if it's doable because of the constitutional right to travel between states.
Okay.
Yes, when there's a health emergency, we can have restrictions. But as you know, they're not closing down the airports. And if they don't close down the airports, it's very hard for us to say, don't take a plane. That would be my advice to anybody right now.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not traveling to my sister's for Thanksgiving for the first time in, you know, 75 years.
Wow.
She lives in Davis, which is right near Sacramento. She's the presiding judge of the juvenile court in Sacramento. And the other thing is, you know, I don't want to take a plane. And if I drive, you have to worry about, should I stop at a gas station? You know, what do I do?
Yeah.
Where am I going to stay? I'm not part of their pod. What am I bringing into them? So instead, I went to Crate and Barrel. I bought 2 orange napkins, and I'm having Thanksgiving dinner with my best friend, just 2 people.
And you know what? I think for a lot of people, Supervisor, hearing you say what you just said, what you're giving up and how you're planning to go about it this Thanksgiving, I think is very reassuring. Because I'm wondering, just one last thing, you know, Governor Newsom is taking a lot of heat for his dinner that he had at French Laundry, that very fancy restaurant up north. How disappointing was it to hear and see the leader of the state, the one person at the top of all of this, trying to get this state through this, have that kind of a misstep?
Well, you know, I never thought Gavin was stupid, but that was the first word that came to mind. And not just because it didn't look good, but because everything he's been saying about how dangerous this pandemic is true. And therefore, you should not stupidly go have dinner at the French Laundry or Denny's. I don't care. We're all giving it up. Everybody sacrificing. Please, you should too.
That's Los Angeles County Supervisor Sheila Kuehl. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Kind of feels like Southern California school districts have been seemingly in constant reopening planning mode. And it's not their fault because they do need to be ready just in case things get better and they can let kids, in the words of John Mayer, bust down the double doors. Alas, with SoCal now solidly in the most restrictive tier, we'll hear what all of that means for LAUSD's 2021 plans. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. As California cracks down again on the coronavirus, instituting a few more rules and regulations, we want to know what this means for schools, those that have already allowed students back to campus, and also LA Unified, which has been trying to come up with a plan when and if kids can return to school in person next year. KPCC's Carla Javier is here to tell us all about that. Carla, so let's start with the districts and counties where kids had been allowed to go back to campus. So what does this slip back into the purple tier mean for those schools?
So in Southern California, that applies particularly to Orange, Ventura, and Santa Barbara counties, because those counties were in less restrictive tiers for a time, and their schools were allowed to reopen for a time. Now that they're back in the most restrictive purple tier, the schools that had already reopened will be permitted to stay open. But schools that had not reopened yet, generally speaking, have to stay in distance learning now until the county makes it back into the second most restrictive red tier for at least 2 weeks. There's also this squishy middle ground for schools that had reopened for some grades, but not all of their grades. In Orange County, they're asking those schools to contact local health officials. In Ventura, they're permitting those reopenings to continue.
Squishy's the right word there, Carla. Now, okay, to LA County now, and LAUSD specifically, California's largest district, a plan has been in the works for what a return to campus would look like whenever it can actually happen. So what now is the plan?
Well, big picture, the plan is to get a plan in place before it's actually time to go back sometime in 2021. Since LAUSD is not applying for waivers, they cannot actually fully go back until LA County can reduce the spread of COVID-19 enough to get out of that purple tier. So that planning part, that's the part of the process LAUSD is in right now. They have this big COVID testing program. They're trying to establish a baseline among students and staff. Superintendent Austin Buettner has been sharing some of the different distancing and cleaning protocols the district has developed, including those like Ghostbuster-esque electrostatic cleaners that you may have seen. And now, officially, the district is also giving parents the choice between two options, going back in what they call the hybrid model, whenever that's allowed, meaning some in-person classes, some online, or staying online only.
Now, obviously, the union, United Teachers LA, has to sign off on anything. How are those negotiations going?
Well, the union and the district have made some agreements when it comes to like limited in-person assessments and tutoring. But for a more general hybrid reopening, neither side has really made an announcement about an agreement being reached just yet. As for what the district is telling families about that, the communities of schools are holding these town halls for parents to help them understand the decisions that they're going to have to make about this. And at those town halls, or at least the ones that I've popped into, they're saying that the details of in-person hybrid learning, like how long and how often students will be on campus, are still being negotiated.
You mentioned those town halls being held for families all week about this return to campus. What can parents expect to learn if they tune into these things?
There'll be some explanation about the state's tier system and how that relates to school reopenings. Administrators are encouraging families to get their to sign up their kids for COVID tests through the district's testing program. There's a lot of emphasis on these three S's: screening, sanitizing, and social distancing for everyone who's on campus. But the main part is that they're laying out these two options that families have to choose from, that hybrid learning I was talking about, or the other option, the online only option, which is what families are doing right now. And they're also explaining the next steps in that selection process.
Next steps. So what are those next steps? Are parents expected to make any decisions now about whether they would send their kids back to school in person should the doors reopen at some point?
Yeah, the district is sending guides with summaries of that information I was sharing, and the parents have until December 6th to make a decision about whether they prefer the hybrid model or the online-only model. LAUSD expects that most families will choose the online-only option, but all of that being said, December 6th is just the deadline for the decision. As we've been talking about, there's still too much spread of COVID-19 in LA County for schools to reopen, so any choices that parents are making right now would apply for after LA County gets out of this most restrictive purple tier.
I go back to that squishy word. All deadlines are squishy in COVID era in a lot of ways. Okay, so what if families don't fill out that form for each of their kids?
So the default option, students who don't have a form filled out will automatically be placed in that in-person hybrid model. Now, the district says if families are in that hybrid model, then change their mind. Maybe they don't feel comfortable. They can switch back to online only at any time in the year. But the reverse isn't true. If they start out online but decide they're actually okay with in-person, they'll have to wait until certain points in the year to change their mind.
All right, that's KPCC education reporter Carla Javier. Carla, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ray.
All right, moving on. If there's one thing President-elect Joe Biden is known for, is that he loves trains. He really digs them. On the campaign trail, the former vice president often spoke of commuting to our nation's capital from Delaware on the train. He's estimated that he's ridden over 2 million miles aboard 16,000 Amtrak trains throughout his whole life. So you would think a train-friendly administration sounds like it would be good news for California's very troubled high-speed rail project. But it's possible even Amtrak Joe Biden will not be enough to save it. For an update on what the transition could mean for the bullet train, we turn to Ralph Bartabedian, special contributor to the LA Times and longtime reporter on high-speed rail. Ralph, it's been a little while since we've talked about California's high-speed rail project. So give us a quick recap of the trouble it's run into and where the project stands right now.
Well, hi. Where to begin? The project in 2008, when the voters approved a $9 billion bond issue, was supposed to take 10 years to build. So, 12. So it should have been operational today between L.A. and San Francisco, running 220-mile-an-hour trains that would get from one point to one end to the other in 2 hours and 40 minutes. Well, that didn't happen, nothing even close to it. So the current plan is to just build a starter system between Merced and Bakersfield for about $20 billion, but it's run into a lot of headaches as well. There is no real plan, at least a funding plan or a serious engineering plan, to connect through the Tehachapi Mountains and over the Pacheco Pass in the Bay Area so that this Central Valley line gets linked to where there are a lot of people.
Now, it has a funding shortfall of $80 billion. So it sound, Ralph, like California would need a big bailout from a government agency, ideally the Biden administration. So how likely is that given everything else that's going on right now?
Well, nobody knows what the Biden administration will do. But if you think about the fact that if we need $80 billion or even $60 or $40, we would have to share a big piece of a much bigger pie with the rest of the country on rail projects or transportation projects. Mm-hmm. So the pie gets to be so enormous that it's precluding a lot of other higher priorities for Democrats in the incoming administration. So that doesn't seem very likely. And, you know, I don't think that the High Speed Rail Authority really expects a massive bailout. What they want is a more functional relationship with the Federal Railroad Administration, which they really haven't had for the last few years. They hope they could get a reversal of the decision made earlier this year to terminate a $929 million grant, so that would give the state $1 billion, and a relaxation of some of the really tough well, they weren't originally tough, but they're tough now to meet original deadlines for completion of some construction in the Central Valley and completion of all these complicated environmental documents that need to be done by 2022.
Well, Ralph, a more functional relationship with D.C., I mean, that part at least is in the bag, right? I mean, it's got to be better than what they got out of President Trump.
It does. Even a friendly Democratic administration is not going to excuse a lot of mistakes. And in the tail end of the Obama administration, Obama officials got a little tougher, quite a bit tougher with the state, setting up some really demanding requirements that had to be met under the grant agreements. So, yes, they will certainly be more peaceful relationship, but I don't even think you can say, well, anything can go now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's still a lot of money to hand over to any state for any reason. So, yeah, definitely not. We're speaking with Ralph Vartabedian, special contributor to the Los Angeles Times, where he regularly reports on the high-speed rail project. Right off the bat, though, Ralph, what could a Biden administration do right off the bat to support the project, maybe, if it wanted to?
Yeah, they could reinstate the grant.
Okay.
That would be a big infusion. They could relax the deadlines. But I think a lot of people who are supporters of this project feel that California, if they really want federal help, has to demonstrate that it has a credible long-term plan to complete this system and connect it to the L.A. and San Francisco centers. It can't just keep kicking the can down the road as it has been doing for so long, saying, well, all we can build now is this small segment in the Central Valley, but it'll demonstrate that we actually have a system.
So
probably it doesn't work.
So, Ralph, let's just say Joe Biden does reinstate the grant. It seems more than willing to offer whatever help that is reasonable for the new administration to offer on the high-speed rail project. What would it mean for the timetable on the bullet train, though? Are we still looking at more delays down the line, even if all of these things fall into line?
If you're talking about the Central Valley segment, well, that's probably... is supposed to be completed by 2027 at a cost of $20.4 billion. But I did a story a couple months ago that really looked at that. And there are so many change orders that are coming in at very high cost, you know, in the $500 million a pop realm, that they're going to have a possible funding gap to complete that. So the $1 billion is critical. They'll probably need some additional money beyond that. It could slip a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the rest of it, the tunneling through the Tehachapi Mountains and through the Pacheco Pass will be the most complex and difficult tunneling job we've ever done in this country. So it's going to take a lot of money and a lot of willpower to get that done.
Really quick, Ralph, we only got about 30 seconds. When did you start reporting on this? And when you started, how long did you think you would be reporting on this for?
Well, I didn't really want to report on this. My editor said, well, just write a couple stories and, you know, get it out of the way. That was in 2011. I'm now up to, I think, 251 stories on this project. So
those are danger words from an editor. Just write a couple of stories, Ralph. That's it. Just a couple. That's Ralph Vartabedian, special contributor to the LA Times, where he often reports on California's high-speed rail project. Ralph, as always, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks a lot, eh?
All right, so say what you want about his political career, but the president does have a solid track record of highly rated reality TV shows. But that was way back then. Now, when he leaves the White House, what will his post-presidency look like? How about another TV show, this time on his own network, Trump TV? That could be next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, and you can also find us on Apple Podcasts. I'm Amy Martinez. After Donald Trump leaves the White House, could he become a TV mogul? Well, there's talk of him possibly mounting a network that could be an alternative to Fox News. And in an entirely different part of the entertainment business, Spike Lee is prepping a movie about the origin of Viagra. And how about this? It'll be a musical. For this and more, it's time for our weekly segment, On the Lot.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Joining us now for a dose of entertainment news is Rebecca Keegan, senior editor for film for The Hollywood Reporter. All right, Rebecca, so let's start with this idea that President Trump maybe could launch a TV network after he leaves office. I remember during the 16 election, there was something about him launching, what, Trump TV, which actually did not continue after he won. But how real is this new idea?
Yeah, it didn't continue after he won because he had another job that was being the president.
And he was on TV. He's on TV all the time. So, I mean,
true. Yeah. He definitely gets his TV time. But yeah, so this is real in the sense that Trump brings with him an enormous potential audience of loyal followers and a fundraising machine that he built as president. And people in Trump's circle are now kind of dusting off those very Trump TV plans that you remember hearing about in 2016.
It's actually quantifiable, the amount of viewers, actually a little over 70 million that he could actually bring with him.
That's right. That's right. Safe assumption that if you voted for him, you would want to watch him on TV. But it's interesting there, you know, there are a bunch of different ways Trump could go with this network. There are the sort of traditional cable news channel path, or there's a digital venture, and both of those come with challenges. A cable news channel would be a lot more expensive to get off the ground. And with more and more people cutting their cable plans, cable companies are not looking for new channels right now. There are two existing conservative news channels that have small audiences and have kind of positioned themselves as alternatives to Fox News. That's One America News Network and Newsmax. And Trump could, with the help of investors, either buy one of those channels or put his name on one of them in exchange for a share in ownership. And then the digital venture would be cheaper and faster to launch, but he'd have to entice paid subscribers one by one, and it also can be hard to secure major advertisers.
You know, if Jeffrey Katzenberg knew back then what he knows now, he could have tried and sold Quibi to President Trump.
Oh, gosh. What an unlikely pair those two would be. Yeah.
But money, it's money between two people.
It's money. So, yeah. Yes, on that they could connect.
Yeah. Now, okay. Now, people may not remember that after Al Gore lost his bid for the presidency against George W. Bush in 2000, that he actually started a cable TV network called Current. So, Rebecca, remind us what that network was about and what actually became of it.
Yeah, remember Current?
You do.
Good for you. Because I was going to say I had completely forgotten It was an independent news network aimed at progressive politics. Keith Olbermann had a show on there.
That's why I remember.
Newsom had a show on there. Yeah, for Keith Olbermann's show. But the network, it kind of never really found its footing. And in 2013, Al Gore and the other backers, who included Ron Burkle, Comcast, DirecTV, sold it to Al Jazeera for about $500 million.
You know how I remember it? Because, that's when a sports guy, Keith Olbermann, was turning to news. Like, what an idiot. A sports person turning to news? How could he?
What a dramatic career change. Yeah. Well, it didn't work out for Current anyway.
Yeah. We're talking to Rebecca Keegan, senior editor for film at The Hollywood Reporter. By the way, I'm making fun of myself when I make fun of Keith Olbermann there. So just in case anyone is wondering or is mad that I'm making fun of Keith. All right. So let's move on now to a totally different topic. So tell us about this new Spike Lee movie. It's based on an Esquire article called All Rise, The Untold Story of the Guys Who Launched Viagra. And it's actually, Rebecca, a musical. So what do we know about this?
Yeah. So this Esquire article traced the discovery and marketing of Viagra. And Lee is adapting it with a British playwright. And yeah, it's a musical. The songwriters who created the Tony-winning musical Passing Strange will write the musical. This may seem a little out of character for the filmmaker of, you know, sort of serious-minded political movies like Black Klansman and Defy Bloods, you know, or the Katrina documentary he made. But Spike has done some work in musicals. He you may know, directed the new film of David Byrne's Broadway musical American Utopia, which is on HBO right now. And that's essentially, you know, a concert film with Talking Head songs, a Janelle Monáe song. So he's dabbled a little bit in this area, and now he'll be full on making a movie musical.
Rebecca, you know that I love going to the movies. I love spending all day in the movie theater. It's just what I do. I love doing it. But if this Spike Lee movie about Viagra lasts longer than 4 hours, I'm going to call a doctor.
Yes. Yes, I hadn't thought about all of the potential side effects of the Spike Lee Viagra movie, but it's good to point them out.
And potential dumb jokes that people like me would make about this movie. All right.
There's going to be an infinite number of the dumb jokes.
Oh, absolutely.
There's really no end. Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Now, finally, it wouldn't be on the lot without us talking about the state of the movie theater industry, because we both love it so much. Universal has struck a deal with one particular movie theater chain. So what's that arrangement?
So this week, Universal struck a deal with Cinemark Theaters, similar to the one it had struck previously with AMC. The way the deal works is that Universal is allowed to make its movies available on demand not long after they open in theaters. And in exchange, the studio will share some of the revenue they make from that with the theater chains. The deal with Cinemark varies depending on how well the movie is doing in theaters. So if a movie opens to 50 million or more domestically, it can go on demand after 31 days. If it opens to less than 50 million domestically, it can go on demand after 17 days. Normally the window is 74 days. So this is a very, very big difference.
That kind of tiered system, like that actually kind of makes sense. I mean, it makes sense, like if a movie, you'd want the options, right, to make money anywhere you can make it, especially in these times. So what movies will Universal be releasing this way?
Yeah, it does make sense. It's dynamic is what they're calling it. And the first couple of movies, next couple of movies out from Universal include a DreamWorks animation film, The Croods, A New Age, which is coming out on November 25th, and then will go on demand. Freaky, which came out November 13th, will also go on demand. I think what's noteworthy here, A, is that this is not just a deal that Universal is striking with these theater chains for the pandemic, for these strange times that we're in. This is a long-term change to their business model. This is a multi-year deal. So it'll still be in effect when the Fast and Furious movie comes out in May of 2021. And it's a major change that, frankly, studios have been pushing for years. And the extraordinary financial stress of the pandemic has really forced theater chains to buy in.
You think other movie studios are going to strike similar deals, or maybe wait to see how this one pans out before they do that?
Well, all the studios are watching this closely and weighing the value of a deal like the ones Universal is making. But they're also weighing it against some important issues for their businesses. Like some companies, like Disney, for instance, also want to drive consumers to their new streaming services. So they have other calculations that they're making. Each company is kind of unique in the way it's approaching this, but there's no question that all of the studios have wanted this window of time between when something's in theaters and when you can see it at home to get smaller, and the pandemic has accelerated that.
One more thing, Rebecca. I'm wondering how you think Hollywood studios are hearing about the news of vaccines possibly coming next year, early next year. I mean, I'm wondering if it affects dating certain films that maybe have been pushed, or is it too soon to even start even heading down that road?
Well, you know, it's probably no accident, A, that the really big movies start coming out around next April.
Yeah.
So the vaccine is part of that thinking. And I think the studios view the prospect of the vaccines as some welcome good news, but there's still a lot of uncertainty around timing.
All right. That's Rebecca Keegan, senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, well, we just talked about movies, and usually the kind of thing in a movie that gets people out to the theaters is big name, star power. Well, that kind of dynamic also works when it comes to podcasts, especially lately. If you got a name you recognize hosting a podcast, say a big star, you might be more likely to listen to that podcast. But what does that do to the scrappy DIY types who want to make a podcast out of nothing? We'll find out when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. So what's the scenario? Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ian Martinez. We've seen the podcast world evolve rapidly over the past few years, and a lot has changed for the content creators over the course of that time. Now, this week, Nick Kwa, the host of the LA Studios podcast Servant of Pod, talks with a creator who's been making fiction podcasts since 2015. For perspective, that's not too long after This American Life dropped the first episode of Serial. That was October of 2014. Lauren Shippen is primarily known for her fiction podcast, The Bright Sessions, and is also the creator of podcasts The College Tapes and The AM Archives. All right, Nick, so first things first, tell us a bit more about Lauren Shippen and her work and why you decided to interview her.
Yeah, so I've been tracking Lauren's career for a while because I think it's like an interesting model of what's possible, or maybe like what was possible for creators who are working to build a name for themselves in the podcast space. Her breakout work was The Bright Sessions, as you mentioned, and she kind of describes it as like a In Treatment. I don't know if you've ever seen that show, Beat Superheroes. You know, which is pretty apt. So she created a show when she was trying to do this like aspiring actor thing in LA, like auditioning for gigs, waiting for tables. And it's one of those situations where a side project ends up cultivating a strong following. And flash forward a few years later, she's now one of the busier people in the podcast business.
So what led her into the world of podcasts? Why did she decide to create The Bright Sessions?
So the way that she tells her story, it was a mix of bad luck and good timing and basically just making the best of what you got. So she tells me like around the 2014, 2015, she was doing the LA thing, you know, trying to get gigs and trying to make money on the side. When she developed kind of a bad health condition that took her off her feet, while she was recuperating, she decides to pull out a script that she's been working on and flip it into a podcast because it's something to do. And it was also something that she could do with her physical requirements at the time. And here's a clip of her talking about that stretch.
I came back to LA and had sort of gone through the process of putting my life back together with the job and the voice lessons and the speech therapy and everything else. I had 9 scripts and a couple of friends in acting class that I had been eyeing for roles who were very willing to do stuff for free simply because I said, it'll take, you know, 2 hours per episode max and you won't have to do anything except show up and like read from the script. Like you don't have to memorize your lines. This is going to be the most luxurious thing ever. And they were so down.
You know, it's like a clean story in hindsight, but I'm sure it was messier. But, you know, it's that kind of origin story all the same.
And that's a cool one, too, because it's someone down on their luck and that, for whatever reason, in a weird way, gives them time to kind of clear their mind and come up with something cool. Now, Shippen first launched your show back in 2015. That's about 5 years ago. So long ago. So what can you tell us about the podcast industry back then and how it's evolved since?
As we've, I think, discussed a bunch of times before, it's basically night and day at this point. 5 years ago, a lot of folks were still just finding out about podcasts for the first time. A lot of people had been making podcasts for quite some time by that point, but we're still trying to figure out how to build an actual business. And cut to today, you know, there's a lot more money, and there's a lot more companies, a lot more players, and there's a lot more bigger, like, corporate entities putting money into the space and bringing bigger name talent from elsewhere. And so there's this general feeling of anxiety, and Lauren talks about this, and I've heard other creators native to the space talk about this a lot over the years, who are worried that the influx is, like, crowding out the space to a point where if you're not a TV actor or somebody who has, like, a presence elsewhere, you know, could you break out? That's the big question on everybody's, like, lips right now.
Yeah, all right, we're talking to Nick Kwa, host of the LA Studios podcast about podcasts, Servant of Pod. Now that fiction podcasts, Nick, are starting to get picked up and adapted for TV, how has that changed the podcast space?
Like a lot of things that look like progress, it's both good and bad. On the one hand, the more this trend picks up, the more like potential pools of money there is for podcast creators to make, which is great. You know, a couple years ago, they were struggling to pay rent. These days, not so much, maybe much less so, who knows. And I think that even back then, 5 years ago, people were really struggling to conceive even of a career in this space. And so what this influx has brought, just the opportunity to build out an actual career. But it's not unlike, you know, what happens to like a beloved little restaurant that blows up or something. Suddenly everybody's flying in, they want to eat there, they crowd out the locals, maybe the quality of the restaurant changes. At the end of the day, you know, it's unclear who's really happy.
Yeah, it's good for some, but maybe not great for the people that have been there from day one. So what's been Lauren's experience with that changing landscape?
Yeah, she's still grappling with that. I think she's still trying to sort of really think through what this all means. And she talks a little bit about that in this clip.
I'm incredibly grateful for the opportunities that I've had and like the collaborators I've been able to work with and the projects I've been able to work on, and unbelievably grateful that for the past 18 months I've been able to make a living from fiction podcasting. But it's still a constant uphill battle. And I think the thing that I'm experiencing now is just the fact that audio fiction is much bigger and especially with, you know, sort of Hollywood studios getting into it and maybe not choosing instead to work with like TV and film writers, that I'm still constantly proving myself to the people who hold the purse strings.
And you know, Nick, something she just said right there really struck me. I mean, so this is someone that knows what they're doing, that has just really put their heart and soul into this. And she sounds in a way that she's just relieved that she's getting by. I mean, my goodness, it's just, it has to be a very difficult life at times for someone that doesn't have a humongous superstar name to try and exist in this space, even someone like her.
It's something that I also struggle with. I'm trying to sort of really think through it, because it's this whole notion of like, when do you know that you've made it, right? And I think the reality is that like, the kinds of people who is drawn to this kind of work, this kind of world, you know, maybe you'll never really get that feeling of like, you've made it, or you have shots that you can take all the time. I think the thing that I'm sort of gathering from having all these conversations and really talking to Lauren is that there's always this other door. There's always this other challenge to get to that point. You're never always going to get to a point where you can do whatever you want. And it always feels like an uphill battle. I don't know if you feel like that in your career, but you know, I'm not particularly famous or successful, but I am more comfortable in my media spot than most other people in my peer group. And even I feel like I'm drowning all the time.
Wow. But no, that's interesting, because yeah, you never know, right? I mean, how do you measure what success is? Or is it just if you can make a living, pay your bills and create what you want to create?
Absolutely. And I don't know what it looks like on the other side, right? And I'm sure even, you know, if I have all the money in the world and all the opportunities in the world, there is a way in which this kind of life keeps you in that kind of spot of unhappiness, maybe, or just discomfort, really.
Is someone today that is unknown, say they're starting right now, Nick, because that's the thing with the podcasting world. I'm wondering if someone right now decides, okay, I want to start from scratch, I want to do this. Is it possible for that kind of person, someone who has no known entity in the market, to survive and find success?
That's a really good question. And I think it has become the question, at least in my coverage, my work, that has popped up the most. Like, it's the kind of conversation that a lot of podcast creators want to talk about the most. My impulse is that, you know, with things like this, like with new mediums and technology, and like you combine that with a little bit of like fame and more attention, we're in a position where we kind of really put the genie back in the bottle, right? We're not talking about a situation where we can just like excise 60% of people who are podcasting right now so that like people with no names can pop up a little better. It's a little bit like saying like I miss the days when baseball players were just like slightly athletically gifted everyday people yeah. as opposed to people who have spent their whole lives training to become superhumans, essentially. I think the focus right now is to essentially like kind of live with what we got, create new structures within whatever the space is now to foster like greater accessibility and inclusivity for people who haven't made their name elsewhere. So like creating good pipelines, creating good entry level sort of ways to get noticed and get audiences. Hopefully somebody's doing that work. Then more of that kind of work and more of that kind of structure building should be happening. We'll know like 1 or 2 years from now if we keep seeing the same stuff being released over and over again by the same kind of big names.
Because I kind of understand from the investor's end of things, Nick, you know, if I have a lot of money and someone pitches me, okay, this person's great to listen to this, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, I don't know who this person is. You know, what you want me to put my money in this person? They better be brilliant, right? I mean, they have to be just jumping out of the podcast, right?
Yeah, I mean, I like to think about things in terms of like controlled risk, right? And then you can think about something like a film studio. Like, you know, people talk about Blumhouse a lot these days, that sort of horror film studio based in Blum. The narrative's a bit overblown, but the idea of just using a smaller pot of money to invest in names that are either was big or not that big and just like let them go and like figure out a way to build the upside for all parties and just play strategic bets that way. That's one way to do it. And I think this notion of just de-risking everything, that's going to lead to sort of poorer products in the long run, I think.
That's Nick Kwa. He's the host of the LA Studios podcast about podcasts serving a pod. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Hey, make sure you join us tomorrow on Take Two for our special called The Invisible Wall. A lot of the focus on immigration the last 4 years has been on detention centers or the actual wall, but we're going to talk about all the different ways the Trump administration has chipped away at legal immigration over the years. The Invisible Wall. That's coming up tomorrow at 2 on Take Two. Make sure you join us for our special called The Invisible Wall. We'll talk to you tomorrow, too.